So I've spent the last week traveling, and traveling in a way that meant that I heard multiple sermons during the week, which is absolutely my idea of a good time, maybe not yours. And weirdly, one of the first I heard on Monday used this verse reading, this Acts reading, which is just the gift that keeps on giving. It is packed. So in most years, many years, you could start with eunuch, right? I'm absolutely envious of every parish called St. Philip because I get to do this every year. We don't, the rest of us don't get this reading every year. What is a eunuch in the Bible? What does it mean that this is the one of the first stories, if not the first story of conversion in this way, is for this person? So eunuch, a person who either is differently bodied in their birth or is forced to change their body in some way because of subjugation, or chooses to change their body. There it is right in the beginning of Acts. This is the beginning of the church, a person whose the private parts of their body have been altered in some way to not fit the binary. First person to say, what is to keep me from being baptized? Not to be changed back, not to be changed into something else. What is to keep me in? Philip could have said absolutely everything about you, friend. All the things. I'm sorry. That's just what the Bible says. But he doesn't. That could be the whole sermon. We could just talk about that. But other years, the fact that it's an Ethiopian eunuch, right? An Ethiopian eunuch. So taking us to the time of the ancient world where Ethiopia is at the center of things. In the way that we think about how we learn about the world, right? So Ethiopia, Egypt, Persia, the center of things. Ethiopians among the most sophisticated culture of the time and the most powerful by far. Israel is a backwater at this time. Jerusalem is a tiny little place with a very nice temple, right? Ethiopia, a rich, powerful person, and as Anna Carter Florence reminded us earlier this week in a sermon, she's at Columbia, but I heard her in Minneapolis. The ancients, and you will remember this from school, right? That the ancients considered Ethiopians the most beautiful people in the world. The most beautiful people in the world. I say it for the undoing and undermining of all the things that have come since, and to remember how different the ancient world was. The things as they are today are not how they've always been. So this person, and you just kind of know in the world of the things, like if you're a eunuch, you're probably even better looking than all your other people. That's just how it goes. In a chariot, think about how many chariots you've heard about in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament. As the young people might say, Jesus and his disciples didn't have chariot money. They weren't those kind of people, right? A chariot. So there is a dark-skinned person of gender we don't have, extraordinarily wealthy, extraordinarily well-educated, reading a scroll, right, in Hebrew, and owns a scroll of Isaiah, going by in a chariot, and poor Philip the Deacon, I feel bad for Philip already. Philip the Deacon is, for all those guys, are from a backwater somewhere, and they would say that you could tell at the beginning of Acts by their accent, by the way their Aramaic was accented, they were Galileans. I don't know the town in Georgia that I should name for you all to get the metaphor, but you've got it, right? He's from there. What do they know over there? Those folks don't know much. That guy, as it says, plucked and like dropped there, and there's the chariot, and has the nerve, I guess sort of if you've been plucked and dropped, you do what the Spirit tells you, right? That to go and say, do you understand what you're reading? To that person. There could be the whole sermon right there as well. And he gets in this chariot with this man and explains to him Isaiah. Now, one year I did the research to figure out what that part of Isaiah would be that he was reading, what had passed, what was left, what part of Isaiah. He would have already read the part, if it looks like like Isaiah that we have, about eunuchs in Isaiah. There are eunuchs in Isaiah. God, Isaiah the prophet references them. There are eunuchs in Leviticus and Deuteronomy in this way, that there are people banned from going to the temple. There's no other reason to go to Jerusalem as an Ethiopian except to go to the temple. So he would have gone. He would have been curious. Maybe he was interested in faith and religion and practices. So he goes and would have been probably kept in one of the outer quadrants of the temple, but would have gone, has this scroll. Maybe he has an ancestor who is Jewish. Maybe he is Jewish by heritage. We don't know, because the ancient world was that exciting and more and different than the world that we have today. We should not fall into the categories that we have today in this reading. And so he comes back, he's reading the scroll, and so Leviticus and Deuteronomy say that eunuchs cannot come into the temple, and Isaiah says everyone can come into the temple. The prophet defies the older teachings. So all that's happening, and if you're listening in the first century, you're probably thinking all these thoughts. All those things are happening as the framework of this story. And then Philip says, this reading from Isaiah that you are reading is fulfilled in Jesus. Jesus has come, and as we get the illustration in 1 John and in the Gospel, Jesus has come as love. Love has come to this world. God has come to us in love and asks us to abide in that love. And very specifically, to love the people on this earth right now. Because if we cannot, how can we love God who we have not seen, is the challenge in 1 John. There it is. Love your God. Love people around you to begin to understand how to love your God. So there is Philip saying these things to this eunuch, I like to think, oh, maybe the eunuch is like, oh, this is for me, that's good. But I'm guessing this eunuch doesn't have a lot of insecurity. He is in a chariot, after all. He's a powerful person, and not just a eunuch in a chariot, a eunuch in a chariot in charge of the entire treasury of Ethiopia. Again, you can think of the person this is. I don't know, like, who in your mind, but this is not a person that needs to talk to a Galilean and really doesn't need a lot of freeing, probably. Here's the good news of Jesus the Christ, who is for everyone and is compelled by it. And you know being compelled by that would mean the treasury in Ethiopia probably needs to work a little differently, right? That's the kind of convicting that would have happened to that person. That's what happens in this reading today. This Galilean says, Jesus has come. This is the fulfillment of the prophecy that you read in Isaiah. Jesus has come. And the Ethiopian eunuch says, what is to keep me from being baptized? And Philip could have said, way above my pay grade, friend. I don't know if I can do that. This would be a big public screw up, right, if I get it wrong. And he does it. They go into the water together, and this is among the first Christians, among the very first Christians that we have in the world. The ancient church in Ethiopia claims him as their great patron, the ancestor of the church that has kept for us, preserved for us, the connection to ancient Judaism, like pre-rabbinic Judaism, that has the oldest manuscripts, among the oldest manuscripts of the biblical texts in Gez, right, in Ethiopia. In the great libraries like Alexandria and Constantinople, there is the library in Ethiopia. All of this, Philip the Galilean, the nobody, goes and breaks all of the boundaries, all of the borders. Now, Philip is not a no one. He is a deacon who has already preached a pretty mighty sermon somewhere and convinced a bunch of, like, the whole town converted. That's what we get right before this. Everybody. He's compelling. And then he goes and does this thing that has an implication into the future he could not have imagined. Far, far into the future. That could be the whole sermon, too. But this year, it's the first sentence, isn't it? Philip is on the road from Jerusalem to Gaza, it says. Gaza is an ancient place. There's not been a year before, and this, you know, the occupation has been going on for a long time, but there's not been a year before in my life where that sentence stopped me short. And he's going from Jerusalem to Gaza because you would go from the temple down to Gaza, just like you would today, to get to Egypt, to go to Ethiopia, right? He's on his journey home. That border is where people are being stopped right now and people are trying to pass. Right there is where our country is building a dock so that aid can be brought in to Gaza. And you are all reading your papers. You know how that's being obstructed. You know how many people are dying. It's one of the powers of this text for us. Instead of waiting till the end of time to see things turned over, not just metaphorically are we seeing things as they are flipped on their head, the world turned upside down. Here it is in the text for us over and over again. It works this way on us. How we know the ancient Near East, what that means, what that story means, how we think about that today. The ancientness of that place and the people and all the kinds of people that live there in that time. One of the gifts of religious practice for us that are textual, that have texts, is an imagination larger than the imagination of the world that we occupy today. Bigger than your newspaper, bigger than your news, bigger than the people around you, bigger than your fears, even bigger in some ways than your history. We are drawn back to an older time than most of us even learn in history. So that also could be your whole sermon. I think that really is, that's probably your sermon right there, right? Jerusalem to Gaza. And then we read in the Gospel, And this one gets me every time. It is not those of you that are not blooming that are going to get pruned, because that is justice. If you're having a hard time blooming in this world, let's prune you back a little bit. But did you hear that? We're to abide in Jesus, abide close to Jesus, stay close, it says. Stay close to that power of love that is in Jesus, that transforming, earth-shattering, salvation love of Jesus. Stay close to it. And as you are blooming, it says, those that are blooming will be pruned back. Right? Those that are removed from Jesus, it says those removed, that those are the ones that are scrap. But if you are blooming, that's tough. We're a congregation full of bloomers, I think. We're blooming people. We're in the blooming time of year. When I was at St. Mark's in the Bowery, right when I got there, I remember there were roses and thorns with massive thorns on them because they hadn't been pruned back, coming, beautiful vines, coming right through the fences and outside into the street. It was really pretty, bright, big, red roses. And it was also a little dangerous, these big thorns out in the street coming from the church, some kind of symbol of the church, I guess. Don't get too close. Definitely don't come to the front door. And it probably in some ways said something about how they were feeling. They were being besieged in some ways at that time. People wanted their property and there was stuff going on. Big thorns. So I thought I had a pretty simple solution. Let's just prune that. Let's just cut it back. It grows back. I know about how roses work. So we did. We cut it back and people were so mad. And they were mad for a long time because it takes a long time for them to grow back, right, in the spring. I think they weren't sure they were ever going to grow back. And as I was watching them be really mad at me, I was like, oh, that actually makes sense. I can't promise they're going to grow back, can I? I think it's how it works, that you cut them down. It's how I've seen it work in other places. Maybe there's a reason they don't prune, I thought, at my worst, at points in the year. And of course, they came back, and they were glorious, and they fit in the space, and they didn't go out the door. And sometimes now when I still walk by when I'm in New York, they're coming out the door again, out the top, like I didn't win that battle, didn't win the metaphor. But of course, they got pruned back, and they grew again. And isn't that the story of our lives, isn't it? And if we abide and love what is pruned back, often are things that we think we must do, the only way we know how to be, the only way we've been so far, the only way we know how to think, the only way to make justice, the only way. And we're okay here. It's what we know how to do. And isn't it sort of the truth that that is the place for most of us where we are most competent and confident in ourselves, that we get corrected? Isn't it one of the ugly things of life, the painful ones? And if that hasn't been your experience, God bless you, I'm so glad. Let it not be. But I think that's actually how the world works, isn't it? That the things we build up in ourselves so we can cope, because life has been like this so far. And it feels like blooming. There sure is a flower on there, but there's a thorn as well, right? It's a little tight, it's a little hard. There's too much hurt really close. Right there, it says, we will be cut back to flourish again. It's a painful truth, but I think it is a truth, one of the profound ones in the text, if we choose to stand close to the love of Christ, if we want to love in that way, the people that we see, the ones around us, so that we may love God. One of the ways love in that larger sense is being manifest right now, as you see, is in these protests that you see on college campuses. I was a chaplain at Columbia for 6 years. I was a chaplain at UCLA before that. So when I was at UCLA, which was a defined period of time, and I needed to leave, I interviewed in New York to be the chaplain at Columbia, the Episcopal chaplain, and I really didn't think I was gonna get that job. And the bishop said, one of the reasons it's a priority for us to have a chaplain at Columbia, he was a child of the 60s, he said, it's what happens on a college campus is a barometer of what's actually happening in our country and of where we're going to go. And I am not a child of the 60s, right? And so I didn't know what he was talking about. It seemed a little ambitious. But he said, this is why we have to be on our campuses, and it's why we need to tell the church what is happening on our campuses, because it's very easy to get removed from what is happening, really happening in the world. Life gets busy. So as I've been watching the last week, as you have, I'm devastated. It is devastating. Then there are a lot of factors, and it is complicated. I don't want to make it sound overly simple. But when we watch ourselves attacking our own children, when our children are being attacked by us, we have gone so far wrong. It is love that calls people to tell us, remind us with conviction that war is not the way to peace. war, violence and death is not the way to peace. And now we will not be anti-Semitic. We're not supporting that. We're not going to support that. We're not demonizing Jewish people. But we're not also going to pretend that Palestinians are not people, that those aren't people that this is happening to. And that's what our students are telling us. And they're being violently attacked for it, arrested. You saw the attack at Emory. We have many Emory-affiliated people here in this church. It is devastating. It is devastating. I don't know everything that we're supposed to do. And I don't want to, again, I don't want to pretend that this is simple, but attacking our children is not a solution. Jailing our children is not a solution. And maybe it should be that when we start to think that jailing our children is the solution, we should hear readings like this about love to recall, and landscapes different than ours and times different than ours, to remember that we have choices much more significant, much more important, much more righteous than the ones placed in front of us right now, which is a good or a bad, a simple binary. Remember, there was a eunuch in a chariot from Ethiopia going home from Jerusalem. How does that make any sense at all in the world that we know? And a simple man comes to him and says, liberation has been proclaimed for all, whoever you are. Don't believe in a binary or a distinction, those distinctions. You don't have to. We don't have to. And the man says, may I get in the water with you and become one of you. What a holy witness we have on this day. And there will be a time, this time, there will be times when you are called to bear witness to the liberating love of Christ that you know. It is such a hard time to speak. I know that you all feel the exact same way I do. I have no desire to raise up the anxiety of any Jewish person, any of their fears about safety. We are a safe place for everyone. We will all be. We can all do that together. And we cannot be silent about what is happening. We should not be silent. We should not be cowed into not speaking. And that's what's happening. So it takes some sophistication. But we come from people like Ethiopian eunuchs in chariots that read Hebrew and listen to peasants. We can do it. And we are being pruned exactly where we think we are flourishing, because you are flourishing. And we can flourish even more. And with God's help, we will. Amen.